Okay, guys, let's jump into forgiveness. So one of the things that I just want to make clear is last time when we talked about forgiveness, I love the questions that came afterwards. It actually stimulated like so much talking between Michael and I as to how to talk about forgiveness in future and also just to help us this time. What we talked about just as a review is that oftentimes people resist forgiving because they don't know what it is. They often assume forgiveness is saying what you did was okay. Or they often assume that it means it's like nothing ever happened again, like I have to forget it, or something along that line. And that's just not the case. That's not something we could find in Scripture as to what forgiveness is about. If we even look at like just the Merriam-Webster dictionary definition of forgiveness, what we see is that forgiveness is all about giving up the resentment of or the claim to try to get something back from the other person, so to grant relief from a payment, or to cease to feel resentment against an offender. The whole thing about forgiveness, it's really about releasing you. It's about freeing you. It actually has nothing to do with the offender, which is the key. Because if some, like in some of our cases, as we talked about, you heard a couple of my stories, unfortunately, both people that I talked about in my stories have never apologized. They don't want to own. They have zero desire to own. You know, it's if I'm going to wait for them to do something before I forgive, I wouldn't be doing this for a living. You know, I'd be in trouble. I'd be really stuck. And, you know, so for 13 years, I went with a false definition of forgiveness where I tried to get them to own. And that was just painful. And eventually I had to realize that I'm actually doing them harm by trying to force them to change so that I can be okay. And that's why, like Tim Keller and other people who were close to me at the time kept saying, you got to cut, you got to cut, you got to cut the relationship, stop. This is getting so toxic, it's not even funny. And then I needed to work through forgiveness, which ultimately led to a ton of freedom for me. So real quick, I just want to say that forgiveness is a process. I don't want you all to feel like this happens like fast. Kids do a way better job than we do of really forgiving, you know? So like two kids get into an argument, you know, or they get into a fight and like within a couple hours they hug each other and they move on and they're tight, you know, and they're good. They've worked it out and they've fully forgiven. Adults, no, we're not that good at that. You know, sometimes it just wrestles around for a while. And so we really need to know that it's going to be a process. Forgiveness is always part of the healing process. It doesn't matter if I'm working with somebody who's addicted to something, who has anxiety, who is depressed, who is going through marital conflict. It doesn't matter what it is that I'm working on, any topic that you can think or trauma or whatever that would come through a counselor's office, always forgiveness shows up somewhere, or else typically the person is not healed. And that's something that we want to remember. Sometimes it's very overt and they talk about actually forgiving somebody. Sometimes they forgave the person and didn't realize until after. So I was working with a woman who was struggling with anxiety, and we went through the process. She got some really good distance, was no longer feeling anxious like she was before. 4 months later, when Thanksgiving came around, and everybody knows that when Thanksgiving comes around and you get around your family, that's where you discover a lot of times what you need to forgive or that there's things to forgive, right? So she goes, Ryan, you know, after Thanksgiving, she called me and she said, Ryan, I can't believe it. There was no anger. There was no nothing. It was great. It was a fantastic Thanksgiving. And she hadn't realized that she had forgiven some relatives for certain things in the process of her own healing process. So it's always there. As I said, forgiveness is never saying that what the offender did is okay because it wasn't okay. It's never that. It wasn't okay. It wasn't cool. It's always about being free from the justice your heart feels like it deserves. It frees you from the burden of the offense. It lets you kind of, in a sense, live again. Breathe again. It lets you move forward and not have your life dominated by whatever offense it was that really harmed you, which is the cool thing on earth. So just to give you a feel for it, even though last time was painful because I was getting into some nuances of some things that I hadn't quite seen the way I had seen them before until I started talking to Michael, I've fully forgiven my dad. I've fully forgiven my mom. If they were to come into the room and say, man, I'm so sorry for what I did, you might see tears because there's hope for a relationship. But it's not because the wound has been itched. I don't feel a wound anymore. I feel free. You know, so it's always kind of like forgiveness. The good news about forgiveness is it's about freedom, which is beautiful and what we want and what we really want. Forgiveness also has nothing to do with reconciliation. Nothing. It has nothing to do with reconciliation. Scripture does command us to move towards reconciliation. So that is clear in Scripture, but that's step two. And what I love about Romans is Romans says, if at all possible, live at peace with all men. Reconciliation isn't a guarantee. Wish it was, but it isn't. What I usually see in my counseling practice, when somebody fully forgives somebody, the coolest thing typically happens. They tell me about how free they feel. Often there's tears, there's some joy, there's all sorts of relief, depending on how big it was. Then typically the next thing that I see they do, which is always kind of freaky, is they know clearly what boundaries to set with the person who was the offender. And often when they're pursuing reconciliation, they keep those boundaries there in the hopes that they can start pulling some of those boundaries away if the person decides or chooses to make certain changes that won't lead to more and more offense. And so typically, reconciliation is the second step, which we're not even going to talk about during this process, but I just want you guys to be clear with that. And so, once again, forgiveness doesn't even have to do with whether or not the offender has changed, whether or not they want your forgiveness, or have asked for forgiveness, or if they're in remorse or repentance. All that's irrelevant. Now, the good news is if somebody who offended you really wants to repent, it is repentant, that makes forgiveness easier. Right? So if somebody owns what they did, our tendency is to let down our guard a little bit. And we start to see that we can say, I forgive you. And then we can move forward. But typically, you don't need it in order to do that. What forgiveness also does is it prevents more from being stolen from you. So it's bad enough the offense happens. Now if you're living your life through that offense, wow, there's a lot more damage that's being done. There's a lot more control that offense has over you. So it kind of stops that process. And ultimately, what typically happens is the longer somebody stays in a state of not forgiving, the more bitter they become over life. And so forgiveness stops that bitterness. And typically, the longer that goes, a second thing that I see is they tend to isolate themselves more and more because they're more and more afraid that other people are going to harm them the way they've been harmed. So they don't consciously think that. That's a heart decision where they say, I can't trust people. And so they just kind of wall off, which makes things so much worse for them. And typically at that point, they look like Tom Hanks, as the extreme example, Tom Hanks in Castaway, or as I like to jokingly say for women, the crazy Catwoman. You know, so that's eventually where all this kind of leads to. So we're trying to avoid any of our friends and loved ones heading in that direction. One last thing about forgiveness is usually forgiveness sometimes involves three different parties. The same act of forgiveness can involve three different parties. So last time we talked a little bit about my dad. One of the things after going through that experience with my dad, when I got back to New York another year and a half later, it started in therapy, I started realizing how angry I was at myself and how angry I was, and this is the one I didn't want to admit, how angry I was at God. Because what I felt was like, why did you give me these two parents? Why? And I was really angry. I didn't want to acknowledge that I was angry at God. That wasn't on my top 10 list. But as we dug in and really got in there, I saw, yeah, I really was angry at him. I didn't think it was fair. I didn't think it was just. You know, I didn't know what did I do to deserve this, quote unquote. You know, so there was all sorts of things. Now, even with God, there is a forgiveness process, even though at the end of the forgiveness process, we're going to discover he was right, we're wrong. You know, so there's still a process there. So at the end of the day, as I kind of walked through this whole forgiveness process and even dealt with some of my anger towards God, what I realized ultimately, just to kind of give you the buttoned up version on this, is that ultimately I was like, I could not have known why God allowed it. But ultimately, what one of my therapists, who was really, really instrumental in my life, helped me to see was that if I was as smart as God, as loving as God, as good as God, if I knew all the ripple effects that would come, if I knew everything, quote unquote, and was holy and pure and righteous and good, I would have chosen to go through the same experience. I would have allowed it. So in other words, what I learned was I was a dog trying to do calculus. I could never in a million years figure out why God allowed all this stuff to happen. It's like a dog doing calculus. We're never going to know. But he's great. He's awesome. He's loving. He wants me. He desires me. And he allowed these things for some purpose that I still to this day don't know what it is. But we're cool. Maybe in heaven there'll be a museum and we figure out all the answers to all these things, or if we even care. But for now, we don't have that. All right, so the sad reality is that most people really don't know how to forgive. And so oftentimes when I have a client and they're ready to start moving towards forgiveness, they often tell me, I just don't know how. Where do I start? My anger flashes up fast, or I think I'm okay for weeks, and then all of a sudden something happens and I'm a mess again, and like, what's going on? And so in the process of like a 13-year process of me trying to forgive my parents in particular, I wrote an article that you have in your handout that kind of helps walk it through. And some of the beginning parts came directly from Tim Keller, who was helping me to kind of forgive and to work through this process. The first thing that you need to know is when somebody's going through a forgiveness process, there's two areas that they need to forgive for the event. They have to forgive things that were obvious. So if a client went through some physical abuse, there were obvious physical abuse signs that they need to forgive. But typically there's also things that are not so obvious. So these are just usually things like implied messages, whether or not the person intended to give it. So from the first workshop we did, my mom never intended, I don't think, to give me the message that unless I have to be ideal in order to be loved. But that message was strongly communicated to me, right? And I saw repetitive patterns and signs that I had to be ideal. So I had to forgive both in order to kind of make a move and change. And we'll talk about that. So just so all of you know, you guys are going to get a copy of these slides, like always. So some of you I saw like wanted me to go back to the previous slide. Don't worry about that. You will get a copy of it. And you also have a handout that has some of this with you for us to look at. Once you make a list of what are the things that you have to forgive, just make a list of as many things you know. What tends to happen is as you start clearing the list, if there's more surfaces. So when I first made a list of things I had to forgive, in my case, my mother for, it wasn't, I have to be ideal in order to be loved was nowhere on that list. I didn't know that. I was clueless. I had to start where I was. And in the process of forgiving, more surfaced until eventually I reached a point where it was clear that I had passed all of it and I was done. And we'll talk about that. Oh, and one more thing that I want to say about this is usually what I do with clients when they're working on this list is after we make the list, you don't have to forgive each and every single item, because in which case, please make sure that Nate, Sam, and Miriam grow up to be therapists so that they could take over for you at that point, right? Because that's going to take forever. The good news is that you just have to like see what the themes were. And if you forgive the theme, the particulars get handled as well. So if I listed, you know, my mom physically abused me twice in my life, but if I listed every time it was verbal abuse, right, or every time it was emotional abuse, I wouldn't be done yet. I wouldn't. So it's the theme. I'm forgiving the verbal abuse. I'm forgiving the emotional abuse. That often helps out the most. All right. So the first thing that we if we're working with somebody who knows the gospel, gets the gospel, the first thing that we need to remember is that we oftentimes when we're in a situation where we have not forgiven someone, what in essence we've done is we've made ourselves judge over that person. So now it's like we're in a one-up, one-down relationship with them. I have the right to judge you because you offended me. And we kind of like that position of power, frankly. Most of us secretly like that because we didn't like that we felt so vulnerable for the offense to have happened in the first place. So it's nice feeling like we're judging sometimes. What we have to do is we feel like we have the right to judge them because of what they did or because of what they're doing. That feels like a natural thing to do. What we have to remember is we need to go from having a one-up, one-down relationship to making them an equal. Because if we can make them an equal, and they're just like us, we can forgive a lot easier. And so one of the ways to do this is we have to look at our own hearts and see what sin in our own heart, if left unchecked, or what sin currently is creating as much damage as what was done to us. Right? So I've never physically abused somebody, but there's other things in my life that if I left them unchecked, they can create that much damage. And I need to see that I am capable, because of my sinful nature, of repeating something and creating damage that was done to me. The more that I can chew on that, the more that I see it, taste it, understand it, the more that I'm aware, what starts to happen is it starts to humble me. And that's usually what we need. We need to be humbled before we're willing to forgive, because that stops the judgment. And in essence, what starts to happen is I see the offender becomes just like me. They're just like me, even though I didn't do the same thing they did. And I probably would never do the same thing they did. Does that make sense before we move on? Okay.
When you say just like, you mean just as guilty?
I can create as much damage as them.
Okay.
They have a sinful nature. They have a sinful nature just like I do.
Okay.
They have a sinful nature just like me, which means that I'm capable of anything they do.
From God's point of view.
That's right. So looking at it from God's point of view, there's nobody in this room that couldn't do the same amount of damage that was done to us. Nobody. That's just normal. That's just where we are. Second is this is going to sound bad at first. It almost sounds like I'm getting revenge, but I don't want it to come across that way. So let me explain myself. A second way you can forgive somebody is you can remember that whatever offense was done to you, it will be paid for in full, perfectly. So either, if they're a believer, either Christ has already paid it by dying on the cross. So for us to try to exact justice is like double jeopardy. And in essence, it's almost like slapping Christ. What you did isn't enough. We need more. Right? So if we kind of chew on that, was Christ's sacrifice enough? Yeah, it really was. It was perfect. So why am I trying to get justice? It's been paid for. If they're not a believer, the unfortunate thing, and they never become a believer, the unfortunate thing is they will spend all of eternity paying for it perfectly. So what we have to see is that sometimes in forgiveness, we think we know how to administer justice perfectly. We have this pride thing about it. But the reality is we don't. And the good news is we don't have to. That's the great news. Christ will take care of it. Make sense? Okay. Third one, see how much God has forgiven you. So sometimes for some of us, we don't have, we can't point to certain sins that we've done that were so catastrophic or whatever, or that, wow, that was huge kind of sins, you know? So when my wife Grace and I were first getting to know each other, and I was commitment phobic when we met. So it's kind of like I didn't want to get married. I was in my 30s, and I was falling in love with this woman, and it was scaring the daylights out of me, right? So I did all the wrong things, in essence, to try to push her away, and thankfully, thank you, Jesus, that didn't happen. So like after like 6 hours of us instant messengering each other, for those of you who don't know, we were introduced by mutual friends. Each mutual friend knew us for at least 10 years. So they knew us extremely well and decided we were a match. And then we started IMing each other and emailing each other and IMing each other. I didn't want to call her on the phone because it was like getting so real and I was freaking out. And so I think after 6 hours or so of instant messaging one another, I said to her, okay, look, we're both over 30, right? So we've been around the block. I'm going to tell you everything I've ever done wrong. Everything. And I want you to do the same. And I figured once she saw the list, we're good. You know, I'm out of this one, right? And so I'll never forget it. I was IMing, and you know how it says Ryan is typing?
Yes.
She wrote Ryan, and she says, you know, it's already been 47 minutes, but it says Ryan is typing. I go, yeah, I'm not done yet. You know? I mean, like, I just cut and paste to put that in. So I wrote everything. And she read it, and what she did was is she read it, and then she came back with like solid, good, healthy boundaries. If this and this ever appear in your life, I want to know, because I want out. But other than that, I'm good. And I was like, that's so freaky, right? So that was like a way in which, in a sense, I saw how much God has forgiven me. If this woman, who's human, with a sinful nature, could look at my list and still want me, how much more must God? Right? And sometimes we don't think enough about our own sin and just what did it cost God? What did it cost him when we did these sins? And if we can remember that the way justice is determined is justice is always determined by the magnitude of the offense. So the higher the offense, the more you have to pay. So if I steal a dollar from you, or I steal your house, your car, all your retirement, your future earnings, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, two different levels of offense, two different levels of payment because of the pain you suffer. What we need to understand is because of how infinitely holy and good and pure God is, infinitely holy, pure, and good God is, even the smallest offense would require an eternal payment. And if we can see our sins that way, it helps us to see that in his eyes, he's forgiven us way more than whatever has been done to us. Because he's forgiven us way more than whatever was done to us, it would be natural to forgive. So the parable of the two men with the different amounts of payments comes to mind. All right, so a fourth way is that one of the ways that you can forgive somebody is by choosing to pay their debt yourself. So with this one, what this means is, I don't know about you guys, but I know that I have not forgiven someone when I'm just randomly driving somewhere and I start arguing with them in my head. Like, I don't care what I've told anybody, once that argument's going on in my head, I know I haven't forgiven them. Because that's a sign of me trying to get justice. I'll give it to you. Here's the debate. Right? And so that's what we kind of do. Another sign, sometimes there's some subtle ways that you can know that you haven't forgiven somebody is you just do the casual gossip thing. Sometimes in Presbyterian circles, it's called a prayer request. Just tailored thus and so to make sure that people get the sting of the bite. You know, and sometimes it's just you start thinking about like things going bad in their life. Whatever is your mode of that, of those subtle forms that tell you you haven't fully forgiven yet, if you literally choose not to do it, so if I'm driving and I start to have the argument, I say, oh, I'm having the argument, stop. That creates a pain because I want to have the argument in my head, because it feels good to be right, to self-righteous and judge them, right? So that feels good. But if I choose not to do that, that creates a pain that starts paying down the debt. And eventually you'll find you won't have those thoughts again. And that's a sign that you're free from from that forgiveness. Does that make sense? Okay. Next, sometimes what we have to see is the offense is so big that no earthly justice could satisfy this. So I'm working with a couple where their 2-year-old daughter was unfortunately raped and murdered. And I'm about to cry, so let me get my emotional control going. The session with them have been more than intense, because the mother discovered her afterwards. And it was horrible. It was a babysitter that they really trusted. So it was horrific. And, you know, the mother, when she described the blood and all sorts of things, more than anyone can handle, right? Tell me, how on earth can she get justice? Tell me. First kid. She's afraid to have more children. Her husband and her don't know how to grieve together. Each one's very afraid that they're going to make the other one worse. There's an incredible ripple effect happening from this that no one in their right mind can imagine that would come from an event like this. And the more that they talk, the more that I see things they have to forgive. I will tell you, as their therapist, it feels overwhelming sitting in the room with them. I really want to get in. I do get in. I bond. We cry together. It's a mess. And when I see them on the calendar, I get a little nervous. I know what this session's going to be. There's no amount of justice that can pay for that. The guy's in jail. They caught him, right? It's obvious it's going to go in the direction that it needs to, right? It's still, what I hear her say things like, so he gets to live the rest of his life getting 3 square meals, TV all day, and comfort, while I have to live with this pain. That's painful, hearing that. She would prefer him doing that than the death sentence. She was like, oh, that's easy. What, a little needle prick and it's over? I mean, she's all over the place. The husband, numb. Scary numb. Scary numb. I had to split them up to do individual sessions just to get him to feel again. And then he finally lost it, which is what we needed. There's no amount of justice. I'm sorry, there's none. There's no amount of justice. If they don't move towards forgiveness, they're going to be trapped for the rest of their lives. And all of us in this room, just from what I've described so far, could see why it would be so easy for them to be trapped for the rest of their lives. One other piece of this that, just to kind of give you a sense for even the higher sense of justice, their family has owned this home for over 200 years. This is the family homestead. And she doesn't know how she can continue to live there. Nor does any other family member. But yet they have, like, if I can't go into details, but if I tell you, like, all the things attached to that house, you would see that as a huge loss. Just even the house. And that's just one little sliver of all of this, right? Sometimes what you got to see is the way you were wronged or the way somebody was wronged was so bad, that there is no earthly justice for it. The court system can't do enough. Just can't. This couple can try to spend the rest of their lives trying to get revenge on this guy in jail. And if they both lived to be 90-plus years old, they would feel like they haven't even scratched the surface on getting revenge. And they're young. so they would have plenty of years. The guy who did it could spend the rest of his life trying to make it up to them for what he did. And at the end of 90 plus years, it's still not enough. Still not enough. Whenever we see that it's so big, so overwhelming, so much that we can't handle it, our only option is to forgive. Because if we don't, the unfortunate thing is more and more and more is going to get stolen. It's almost like the perpetrator did more, as if it's possible, more than just rape and murder a child for years and years and years. That's what it feels like. So you almost have no choice. You've got to forgive. And I'll tell you that this couple's not close to there. And it's been a while since this has happened. So that's why I talk about it being a process. But it's moving that way. Next, what you have to do, one of the things you can do, another option on how to forgive, is you have to pray for it. And so you have to encourage them and others to join them in that prayer. So with this couple, their church is on it. They have people regularly, every week, showing up to pray still, even though it's been a while since this happened. Every week, they just specifically pray for the healing to come to that family. You know, and certain things have changed that have been really good. They're actually pregnant, which was huge. I can't tell you how huge that is. I didn't think that was going to happen at all. Yes?
Did they blame each other for what happened?
No. No, they never blamed each other for what happened. But what it was more like, while they weren't against each other, the pain was so big that they didn't know how to come together. So they tried to, but they weren't being real with each other. You know, and especially on the husband's side, he felt like if he really let himself feel, his wife would have to go to a mental institution because he always feared that she was close to that. She's going to lose her mind. And so he'd try to bottle and stuff and try to be strong. But it was the opposite of what she needed and what needed to happen. All right. So anyway, so forgiveness is a process. And so I often encourage when something's big to have a team of people praying for the person. Not just them, but just a team. Because it is hard to forgive sometimes, depending on what the offense is. Next, another way that you can, or somebody you're working with, can fully forgive is to spend time chewing on what life would be like if you did forgive. So in other words, project out. If you really did forgive, what would my life look like? And get them to stay there. Get them to really think about it. Really think about it. Get it tasted in their mouth. And so you can ask them questions like, what would my life be like if I fully forgave? What consequences would I avoid? Or would you avoid if you fully forgave? What would my energy level be like if I fully forgave? Just any types of questions help. The more they chew, typically the faster we get to forgiveness. Next, some people actually work with creating mantras. So they just repeat a phrase over and over again until it sinks. That doesn't work with me. I don't remember the mantras as much as I need to remember saying them. My brain gets distracted and I go other places. But if you're a mantra person, this actually works, and I've had more than one client forgive this way. So what one client taught me was is that what she did was she phrased it in different ways, and the more she repeated it, it eventually sank. So I'm just choosing the name Jim. So one of the ways she said was, I forgive Jim. I release myself from pursuing the justice against Jim that I feel like I deserve. I choose to no longer try at any level to make Jim pay for what he did for me. Like, she tried to find as many different ways as she could phrase this forgiveness thing until one kind of helped it sink. And that was very helpful for her. Yes?
Does it need to be I statements?
Yeah, typically it's I statements are stronger because it incorporates your will. And that's part of what we're looking for.
Saying, Lord bless them.
Yeah.
But like saying, I...
Yeah, you could actually go the way of God as well. But typically because the act is happening within you, mm-hmm. you would incorporate God by still using an I statement. But it's more of a declaration of getting yourself through mm-hmm. as you're doing some of the other things. For some clients, it's helpful for them to write a forgiveness letter. They may never send it, but just the process of writing it, for some people, it really releases them because they got it all out. And sometimes there they can forgive. Most of the times, my clients actually never send the letter, just so that you guys know. It's still really, really effective for whatever it's worth. Okay. All right. Any questions on forgiveness before we move on through today? We good? All right. Let me just ask if do any of us need a bio break? Because I know some of us had coffee. Because I have another section that I was going to take the break. We good? It's a smaller section. All right. So the next thing that we need to know is what we have to know is that when somebody's going through a healing process, what often happens is that they make whatever needs to be healed the center of their life. So if somebody's, let's say, I'm working with a client who's struggling with pornography, his entire life feels like it revolves around trying to recover from pornography. And unfortunately, what that typically does is it makes the pornography worse. So we have to remember that Christ always has to be the center. No matter what you're going through, no matter what offense has happened to you, no matter how you need to heal, whatever is going on, the fight has to be to make Christ center. And the more you could do that, the easier the healing goes. So we don't want life dominated by whatever it is that has to be done. So one of the things that we need to know is that means that we need to learn to abide in Christ. Really abide. Walk with. Let him be with you. Infuse life with him. And so let me just ask you guys a question. If you had a camera and could follow someone who is really abiding in Christ, what would you notice they would be doing? Let's just give some thoughts. What would you imagine? If somebody's really abiding in Christ, what would they be doing?
Praying.
What else would we see them do?
Spending time in the Word.
What else would we see them do?
Kindness.
So actual actions of kindness. What else would we see them do?
Apologizing and asking for forgiveness.
Yeah, so they're apologizing and asking for forgiveness. They're clearing that slate, boy. What else would they be doing? Yeah, you would probably see a cheerfulness. Yeah. Anything else we could think of?
Being interested in other people.
Yeah, other focused. Less self focused, more other focused. What else would we see?
Also being good to themselves.
They would take care of themselves. They would actually remember, love your neighbor as you love yourself. Go figure. What else would they do? Yep.
Times of stillness.
Yeah. They would actually take time out. And not constantly be on the move. Anything else you can think of? This is a great list. So one of the things that we work on when working with a client is, as Michael described, the process of joining is paramount before we ever give advice. But one thing that typically on the advice column that I often encourage my clients to do is to think more about the gospel. And to really get that in their lives in a way that they've never done before. Because it's totally going to help everything out. And ultimately, it's what God wants for them to do. So when we talk about how to commit to someone and how to commit to Christ, typically, so let me go backwards to show you it in a different way. Sometimes, it's always funny when this happens. Sometimes I'll get a phone call from a couple that tell me they're on the brink of divorce. And when they show up, like when you read their intake, you could tell they both want out. It's just so clear they both want out, right? And then I start to, like the first few years of counseling when I was doing this, I'm wondering, like, why are they coming when it's so obvious they just want out? And then when they get in front of you and they start talking, you could tell they're not interested. It feels like they're checking off a box. We did counseling. Check, right? Like that. Like, you know, and then when we kind of get in there, you know, what they often tell me is, well, we're here because her mother wanted us to come here, or else we would have signed the papers or something like that. Oftentimes, if you are ever with a couple that's there, they're not into the marriage at all. It's kind of grown indifferent. They kind of don't care. They want out. One of the fastest ways that their hearts could come back for one another is if they can find small ways to either invest in the other or something small to sacrifice for the other. The way we show commitment is through our investment and sacrifice. The more we do that, the more we become committed. The more committed we become, the more we love what we're committed to. And then things start to turn around. So when I say a small commitment, I was working with a couple where her father used to always wake up earlier than her mother, and he would make coffee and bring the wife coffee in bed. And so she saw that as a sign of love. And one of the things she mentioned was, in 37 years of marriage, this man's never done that for me. Right? As if, like, you know, bringing coffee in bed is like the standard for love, right? So it's just, but that's where she was. That was her symbol for it, right? So the goal for that week on his side was just once, bring her coffee in bed. Just once. And so what happened was is that they were so disconnected, just to give you a feel for how disconnected they were. He woke up one morning, I think it was like the third day, he forgot the first 2 days, or no, the first day he didn't want to do it, second day it nagged him, third day he was like, fine, I'll do it. Wakes up earlier than she did by accident, didn't even plan it that day, goes down, and as he's making the coffee, he starts to freak out, because he actually doesn't know how she takes it. He's never paid attention. He had no idea how she takes her coffee. So he tried to, like, say, what do I do? You know, he's stressing and all this, right? And so he said, I did not think to just bring up a tray with coffee and have things on the side. Like, he didn't think to do that, right? Which is his way of, like, kind of getting out of it. So he just makes this black coffee, and she doesn't like black coffee, brings it up to her. She's in bed. She had just woken up. He walks in with the coffee, and she's looking at him like, what are you doing? You're actually bringing me coffee? Like, really? She takes a sip of it, and she said she was inches from starting one of the biggest arguments they've ever had in their life, because she realized, being married this long, you don't know how I take my coffee? But she saw his nervousness. She saw how much he really did want to please her. And she wound up drinking the whole thing and just said, thank you. And she said that started the turnaround. So now they're back together, and they're fully back together. They had grandkids, just to kind of give you a feel for, like, how long they've been married, and it was like this. The same thing happens with Christ. The more small sacrifices we can make, or the small investments we can make, the more we're committed to him. And so we want to encourage people who are hurting to kind of move in that direction. So some people think they need to spend an hour every day with God. Well, let's just start with 5 minutes if we haven't done that for so long. Just start somewhere, you know, and just let it build, because usually people feel motivated the more things build. And if they keep it simple, it works great. And so you just want to find ways to kind of get them in there. You guys said all of these. One thing that we also want to encourage them to do is we want to encourage them to meditate or chew on who he is, what he has done, what he is doing, and what he will do. Can you guys think of why we want them, somebody who's really hurting, going through a lot, really want them to meditate on who he is, what he's done, what he is doing, and what he will do? How would that help? It softens you. So one of the first things that tends to do is it brings gratitude into your life. Gratitude is one of the few ways that that we can control that makes us humble. Most of the times when we've been humbled, at least if you're like me, it's because I got a nice 2x4 across the head, you know, when God was like, look, I got to get your attention. But in this case, this is one of the few things we can do that actually produces humility. Any other things you can think of that would come if somebody thinks and starts thinking more throughout the day who he is, what he's done, what he's doing, or what he will do? Anything else you can think of? Yes. Yeah, thank you. And often that's where the problem is, right? So oftentimes the problem's so large that they're so focused on it and they feel like a failure and they don't see how they can overcome it. Well, lo and behold, we have a God who's kind of done everything for us by giving us the gospel. Like, what a concept, right? Maybe we can go to him and maybe he'd help out, right? But most of the times we don't think of that. And so we just need to kind of increase that. The more they can get into gratitude, the more they can share stories of gratitude with others or hear other people's stories of gratitude, the more it starts to melt the heart and changes the perspective. I usually ask a client when we kind of have this discussion, how do they want to be held accountable for abiding in Christ? I don't usually tell them I'm going to hold them accountable, in part because... I'm encouraging you guys to do this in part because they may have other systems out there that would be helpful to get in for this type of accountability. So they might say their spouse, or they might say a friend or whatever, or they might say, Hugh, can we talk about this every other week or so or whatever? Just whatever it is. But that's the accountability often nails it. This brings us to Michael. Next mic switch. Yeah, let's do the break now, and then we will come back and talk about when to refer. So let's take a 10-minute break.
All right. As mentioned before, this next section we're going to cover when to refer. I think it came up a little bit last session. I'm sure there's probably some questions in the first month that... A lot of what we are trying to prepare you to do, there is some ambiguity to it, and there is a lot of gray areas that sometimes Ryan and I, being involved in it so much, forget that when you don't have a lot of experience, it can feel kind of daunting. It can feel like maybe this is not for me. Maybe this is better left up to professionals. So what I want to do in this next section is kind of set some guardrails to hopefully help you feel a little bit more like you can kind of understand where those boundaries are that you can operate in a healthy way, and that there are legitimate times and ways that we can help you identify when, like I said, it is something that's above your pay grade, and it is something that the expectation would not be for you to try and join and continue doing this on your own. So I want to be very clear that what we are about to cover, the goal is to not figure out or understand how to diagnose. Ethically, that's not something that you should be concerned with. There are even provisions in the law that currently right now Ryan and I can't even legally diagnose someone. Only psychologists, psychiatrists, and marriage and family therapists who are licensed in the state of Georgia can legally diagnose. So just to take the weight off your shoulders a little bit, the purpose of this is not to nail and say, okay, now you understand all the criteria for major depressive disorder. Go look for those, you know, check them off, and then refer. That's not the point. And I'll remind you that again, because I really don't want you to feel like that's what we're trying to do, and that's the pressure that you're going to feel. So when you think about taking on this work, you think about doing this stuff, walking with people, joining with them, and you start to realize that there are more severe mental illnesses. What are some of the things you guys worry about coming up, or some of the things that you've thought about as we've talked about this that maybe cause a little bit of pause, things that you've heard, things that you directly might have experienced or worry about?
I would worry about them asking questions.
Okay. Okay, so somebody asking questions maybe that you don't feel equipped to answer or feel beyond kind of your scope, okay? What else? Okay. Okay. So some of you have a little bit more training, so yeah, it might be more difficult to not diagnose.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll keep your comments to a minimum then when everybody else is asking questions. You know what's going on. What are some things that you guys are worried about? I mean, in I'm inviting you to be maybe more candid than feels comfortable in a group, but yeah.
I would ever...
What do you mean by that? Okay. So always thinking about it in the sense of if there's ever a moment I feel like I'm a little unsure here. Okay. Is anybody worried about people who are suicidal? Does that scare you guys? Yeah. It scares me.
Or violent.
Or violent. Yep. Anything else? Go ahead.
Since we're lay people anyway, my feeling is I would be talking to someone I knew.
Right.
Not a stranger.
Right.
And therefore, I would think that I wouldn't be delving into their past other than what they wanted to express that was troubling them at the time. So, at that point, I don't feel like I'm getting that deep. It just depends on how much they want to share.
Sure. So the statement was, being lay people doing this in the church, and we've talked about that. This is happening in relationship. So the idea is, this is going to be with somebody that I know, and they're probably going to only give me the pieces that they feel comfortable sharing. It's a different dynamic than somebody that's paying Ryan and I, right? That they're going to come in on the first session, they're going to say, you're going to hold all of this because I'm paying you for your time and this is what I expect you to do. So there is some difference there. But part of what... sorry, you had said something a second ago.
Oh, I said concerned about making this.
Yeah, that's a great one. So what happens if they're kind of talking about this stuff and I give them bad advice or I refer them in a way that's not helpful? And we can talk about that too. Part of what I want to prepare you for is to understand that even in working with people we know, in giving them space to bring us what they feel comfortable bringing us, there still might be moments where some of these more serious things show up. And Ryan and I would not do a good job if we just told you, no, if you just join, everything's fine. Because you could then be sitting in a situation where you say, hold on a minute. We didn't cover this in our 3 weeks. So I'm going to need you to take back what you just said, focus on me joining with you, and we're going to just stay there. The truth is, mental illness is more prevalent than we like to talk about. So 1 in 4 Americans suffers from some kind of mental illness. And severe mental illness in America, 1.1%, so almost 2.4 million live with schizophrenia, 2.6%, or 6.1 million people live with bipolar, 6.9%, 16 million people live with major depression, and 18.1%, up to 42 million live with anxiety disorders. 60% of adults with mental illnesses did not receive treatment in the previous year. So outside of the church, it's a problem that we know is there. We might know someone who maybe struggled with it or have a relative that we have diagnosed over Thanksgiving break ourselves, right? I know how that works. But the truth of it is, it's more prevalent than we would probably recognize, and it's more untreated than we should feel comfortable with. 60% of these people did not receive any treatment the previous year. That's a little scary. Because a lot of people are living in silence because they don't know how to talk about this. In the church, there was a research project done by Lifeway Research. And they surveyed over 1,000 pastors and about 500 plus churchgoers who either had a severe mental illness or had a family member with a severe mental illness. 66% of the pastors polled said they speak to their congregations very seldomly about mental illness. And the majority of those would say that they spoke about it once or less a year. So it's not something that we're talking about. And there could be various valid reasons for that. But one person in the research study said, we can talk about diabetes, that's seen as a medical condition, but mental illnesses, that's somehow seen as a lack of faith. So we have this dichotomy where pastors maybe don't know how to engage their congregation. We can talk about the physical ailments of people, but when it comes to mental illness, there's almost this, well, how do we know that's really there? Maybe if they prayed more, maybe if they hadn't done these things, it wouldn't be present. We might not say those things, but it's hard not to think that. And it's hard not to, I think, play into the stigma and the silence that follows. Most pastors said they knew someone who had been diagnosed with mental illness. 59% of those had counseled someone who was later diagnosed. 23% of pastors say they have struggled with a mental illness themselves, while 12% had been diagnosed with one. This study dealt primarily, like I said, with pastors, but I included that statistic just to show us that that might be surprising. Actually, for some churches, you might say that's not as surprising, but it's something that affects even our leaders, even people who we would consider our professional Christians, right? They've got it all together. They understand all these things. But when these pastors were given a chance to talk about it honestly, almost a quarter of them said that they had struggled with mental illness. So we kind of have a little bit of a mismatch. There's a psychiatrist actually based here in Atlanta in the study that said more than half of his patients come from an evangelical Christian background, which granted is in Atlanta, so that makes some sense, right? But he said the vast majority of those have not told anybody in their church what they were going through, including their pastors, including small group leaders, everybody. Yes?
Is that primarily depression?
He didn't say, the question is that primarily depression? He didn't say what the issues were. As a psychiatrist, he's probably seeing more severe, so things like depression, anxiety disorders. I don't think it mentioned. It didn't break down what it was, yeah. But what we see is that it's here. Whether we're talking about it or not, it's here. It exists in our churches. It exists in our pastors. It exists in us. But we're not talking about it. So, what does that tell us about mental illness in the church? What are some reactions?
That it's somehow shameful.
That it's somehow shameful. It's not something we should talk about. Something you should work on your own. It's something that's between you and your therapist. Don't bring that here. There's a little bit of that in some churches. What else?
It occurs just like it does in the regular population.
Sorry?
It occurs. Church just like
The church is somehow not exempt from the statistics. What did you say?
That we're afraid of it?
That we're afraid of it. We don't know how to interact with this unknown. We hear people talk about diabetes. We hear people talk about cancer. We understand the treatments for those. But when we start getting into more of the severe mental illness, there's a fear of the unknown. Yeah?
There's an Americanized gospel that's health and wealth and very positive and, you know, success-oriented and all of that.
Absolutely.
If you know church history, you know that great leaders of the church have suffered with depression.
Absolutely.
Bible doesn't say that we're supposed to have this perfect.
Yeah, that's a great point. So there's this idea that our Americanized gospel is to have everything together on the inside. But as you're pointing out, the history of the church actually shows us the opposite, that most of our great leaders in the faith struggled with things that were at times probably could have been diagnosed as major depression, as anxiety. And we're going to talk a little bit in a second about how that kind of comes to be. Any other thoughts?
I think there's a tendency to compartmentalize your life. Where I'm in church, I'm going to have my church mask on. When
right.
I'm at work, I'm going to have my work mask on. And so you just take on and take off those masks.
Right. We can compartmentalize those pieces. And psychological and spiritual are so interconnected that there is almost some sense that while I'm sitting in the pew, if I'm depressed, maybe it is something that's wrong with me spiritually that I'm not dealing with. And yeah,
I was going to say something similar. It seems like it would indicate a lack of true fellowship in the mm-hmm. church that we don't know about these things.
Yeah. So people that might be struggling are saying, why isn't anyone, you know, caring about this in me? Why am I not able to talk about this? Which is isolating and scary. Absolutely.
And everyone else is surprised at these statistics.
Right. Yeah.
I think that the church, all of the above of what everyone has said, but I think the church also is thinking it's this extreme case. And so if somebody isn't this extreme case, and then we can all come around the extreme case, but we don't have any extreme cases.
Right.
Because everyone's compensating in one way or the other.
Right.
So that it's much more mainstream than we ever did.
Yeah, so we see it as a mental illness is that one person that, oh, okay, that makes sense, and they're in a hospital, and okay, that's extreme. But anything else in between is kind of this, well, no, maybe that's just because you could work harder here, or...
Or you're just tired,
yeah.
Especially if you work harder.
Yeah. Any other last thoughts before we move on? So you guys are hitting it on the head. It's more common, whether we acknowledge it or not, it's in our midst. And part of what I want this section to be is, again, not giving you criteria so you understand how to nail these things and diagnose, but hopefully demystify a little bit and make it something that's not this unknown, that's scary, so that as we do interact with it, as churches, as we begin to talk about it, as pastors feel more comfortable talking about it, people can start getting help. So even though we're going to talk about this being in the context of referring, we're still going to get a little bit of understanding of mental illness so we can care well for those that have it. Now, this is one model. This is not the model. This is not to say this explains everything. This not only explains mental illness, but it can also explain mental health. And the way this model works is it says it's a combination of a lot of things, but primarily biological influences, psychological influences, and social influences. So the biological being genetics, your immune system, the way your body is wired. Psychological being beliefs, the way you see the world, the way you interact with the world. Social being, right, the influences of how you grew up, cultural context, your family. So we would say, even in a healthy individual, these three things are working together to make you who you are, to interact, to be a whole person. But when mental illness develops, we can't just say it's because of one of these. That misses the point. If we say mental illness is just biological, we're missing the fact that, you know, if Ryan told his story and you were to say, well, Ryan, the reason that you struggled with this is because, you know, genetically, blah, 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 what would Ryan say? But that was a relationship with my parents. So what about that part? All three of these play into each other.
How does the psychological and the social divide? I understand the top one, but...
ask your question again.
Social and the psychological, how does that literally have two different circles?
Yeah, so psychological would be more inward. So personality, your beliefs. Biological would be, think more like medical, genetics, the things that, neurochemistry, the things inside of you that are functioning that are outside of your control. Psychological would be the things that you have learned to believe, the coping skills, the experiences of things inside of you. Social would be the external.
So it's inner experience mm-hmm. and social is outer.
That would be one way, yeah. That would be one way to...
Mm-hmm.
Correct, yeah. Any other thoughts or questions? Does that make sense? Just as a basic, again, very basic, one way to talk about it. So what does that tell us about how mental illness develops? Broadly.
Your wiring in your brain goes amiss.
Yep. Very complex. Anyone under the right biological conditions, the right amount of stress or input, and in the right environment or wrong environment, you could say,
yeah,
can develop something more severe. So when we look at mental illness, yes, there are certain mental illnesses, there are certain things that you could say people are more genetically predisposed or more likely to. But the reality is, any of us, in the right context, based on our biological makeup, our psychological makeup, and our social interactions, could develop something more severe.
Shouldn't we guard ourselves so that if we know that we that our family history has a certain predisposition genetically, then shouldn't we make an effort to live our lives in such a way to protect ourselves?
Sure.
From like, I mean, if we know that we are predisposed in our family to depression,
sure,
then we would take steps to try to guard against that.
So the question is, if we know in one of these areas that there is a higher likelihood because of family history or genetics or something, shouldn't we work to protect against that? I would say yes, but again, even isolating that one thing does not mean that it then won't happen. Is it wise to be aware of that and protect? Absolutely. Absolutely. But again, it's all of these factors playing together. So when somebody comes to Ryan or I and they start talking about, yes, we want to know, is there a history of depression in the family? That's going to help us. But we also have to be aware of psychologically what's going on. What do they believe about themselves, about the world? What do their social interactions look like? What other, do they have other illnesses? Do they have illnesses that can make someone look depressed? Do they have thyroid problems? Do they, all of these things play in to give a fuller picture. As you said, it's complex. So to say that one thing causes, because you experience trauma, that's why you're depressed, is not accurate. And that's part of when we have that kind of stigma, people that are struggling with these things can start to feel a little pigeonholed, because if it's only about one thing, then what are the solutions? They are also about one thing. If you just did X, then you would feel better. I've tried X. I've done X, Y, and Z actually 1,000 times, and I still feel this way. Why? So we have to start grasping the complexity of it. Again, this is not to help you to diagnose. I can't stress it enough. But it is to give you an idea of how these disorders, how these mental illnesses are very real, can be very bad, and are not that uncommon. And again, this whole section is when to refer. So don't forget that either. We're not talking about this to prepare you to dive in head first. This is to help you understand when to refer. So there are a lot of diagnosable mental disorders, but we are going to focus on just the following: mood, so think primarily like depression, anxiety and trauma / stress related, and then substance use. We're making this very basic. I know there's a lot more, but I don't think we need to get into the more complex ones. So depression. A really easy way to think about depression, without simplifying it or oversimplifying it, is abnormal sadness and low energy. Those are two pieces of depression that show up. There's often a loss of pleasure, inability to focus, sleep problems, too much sleep, not enough sleep. But an abnormal sadness and low energy is common across the board. Common question. How do we know it's not just somebody who's grieving or who's just really sad? What do I mean by abnormal sadness? What does that connotate? What is abnormal sadness?
Chronic.
Okay, so it might be chronic. It might have been there for a long time. That could be part of it. What does it mean if it's abnormal?
There doesn't seem to be any reason that we can find for it.
Okay. So it might be difficult to find a reason. There's something there that's not adding up. That could be a part of it.
It could be the highs and the lows, a lot of crying.
Okay, highs and lows, a lot of crying. What does it imply? What if I removed, what's normal sadness?
The sadness that I feel.
The sadness that I feel in any given day, because it's mine. Okay, like Eeyore. And what does that look like?
Well, okay.
He was also low energy.
He was low, yeah, right? I should play a clip of Eeyore to illustrate this. That would be good.
That's sort of what comes to mind.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we laughed, but I think Craig was very right that what's normal, the only way I have to judge what's normal is myself.
Right.
But I'm not necessarily normal. So that's not
So without getting too narrow in scope, part of defining normal and abnormal sadness, there are cultural pieces to this. So culturally, and Tim Keller writes about this a lot, that we're actually not very good as a culture at grief. And he argues that we're one of the worst in the history of the world. So taking with a grain of salt that we don't necessarily get all of it, if what you're seeing doesn't really fit, and I'll give you two kind of scenarios to see if you can kind of tell the difference, then part of this abnormal is not to say, well, you know, who am I to judge you for this? You know, who am I to say that that's abnormal? But if there are pieces to what you are seeing that seem, again, there's low energy, there's loss of pleasure, and there's something about that sadness that doesn't really fit, then there's probably a good indication that there's something else going on. So we talk about people grieving. We talk about events that cause people to grieve. At Peachford Hospital, where I am right now, a lot of people will come in and they say, when my mom died, my dad died, that's when I got depressed. And we will often challenge them to say, well, hold on. Because everyone has someone die in their life. Everyone. That's true of all of us on the face of the earth. But not everyone ends up at Peachford Hospital because of it. So how do you explain those two things? Often there is an event that maybe caused the grief that is a catalyst that just exposes something that was already there. So we would argue in that sense, you were likely experiencing depression before the death happened. You might not have been aware of it. You might not have named it. It might be something that you've lived with your entire life. But you had an event that exposed or left something open so that it's now bubbling out, coming out. So you talk about chronic. This is often something that people are dealing with a little more. Let me give you two stories, short, and you tell me what you think. So Jeff comes to you, he's in your small group, 2 weeks after his father has passed away, and he mentions that it's been really hard going back to work, he hasn't wanted to come to church, and he's been struggling to connect with his kids and his wife the past few days, and he tells you, I feel so depressed. What do you think? Okay, he's pulled away from everything.
But it's been 2 weeks.
Yeah. His dad died 2 weeks ago. He used the word depressed, though. Does that mean he's depressed? Maybe he's feeling feelings of depressed, but what are you identifying?
I'm identifying that it's a short amount of time after the death and he's going through the grieving process.
We would say that's pretty normal.
Yeah.
He may not be reacting the way we would react, to your point. That might be a little bit different. But you can sense in that, I mean, it makes sense that you don't want to go to work. It makes sense that maybe you're distancing yourself. You're not feeling like yourself. You're sad. That's okay. Second story. Sarah's been a part of your small group for a few weeks. She seems very quiet and tends not to mingle with people very willingly after group is over. As you get to know her, she shares that ever since she moved to Atlanta a year ago, she's been really depressed. She hasn't been able to meet people. She comes home from work and often goes straight to bed. She tells you she doesn't really see it getting better, but she really wants to keep coming to group. She misses the next few weeks of small groups. And when you reach out to her, she says, it's been a really hard week. I haven't gone into work at all. What does that sound like? More normal? No, there's something there, right? You can all identify that's, you're not functioning very well. What's going on? Is a move a really hard thing? Yeah. Is loneliness common in a move? Yes. There are pieces to it that make sense, but there's something else there. Is it always going to be this cut and dry? No, but you know that. And you know people don't fit these stories perfectly. But I do that to illustrate that all of you have a sense of what this means, whether or not you can perfectly articulate it. In these scenarios, you're starting to feel like there's something more there. That's what we want to consider referring. Make sense before we move on? Suicide. People who are having suicidal thoughts are really scary. And it's okay to acknowledge that it is something we don't talk about a lot, and it's something that we're all fearful to talk about. The two things I want to highlight here is understanding the difference between passive suicidal thoughts and active suicidal thoughts. What does it mean to have a passive suicidal thought? What do you think? Yeah. So the way we talk about it in kind of the hospital world, because we see a lot of this, is there a plan? A passive suicidal thought is that idea of, sometimes I feel like it would be okay to not wake up tomorrow. And to some degree, if we're all really honest, we've probably had that at some point in our life. When you're feeling really down, you think, you know what? If I didn't have to go through tomorrow, I'd be okay with that. That's passive. It doesn't mean that you're going to do anything. It doesn't mean that there's a plan. Either way, our first priority, whenever anyone is expressing these kind of thoughts, is to make sure they are safe. And that looks a little different depending on if it's passive or active. One of the common misconceptions is that if I acknowledge what was just said, it's actually going to make it worse. So if somebody just told me that they're thinking, oh, I don't really know if I wake up tomorrow. If I acknowledge, I'm sorry, sounds like you're going through a tough time, and man, this is bad that you don't want to wake up tomorrow. We somehow feel like that's going to put the idea in their mind of, yeah, you're right. I don't, thank you for helping me realize that. That's not how it works. Even people who are actively suicidal, the temptation to not acknowledge is part of what can make it worse by further pushing them into isolation, further having them feel like nobody understands me, nobody's listening to me. So if it's passive, we want to acknowledge it. We want to ask them about it. And that might look like, depending on the relationship, asking, you know, it sounds like you are in a really bad place. Are you going to be okay alone tonight? Are you okay to leave group tonight? Can I call you, you know, in the morning? Can I talk to you? Again, even if it's passive, if it seems like it's something that is wrong, still want to talk to them about, I think we should talk to a counselor, refer, but engage it. If it is active, so what would that look like if somebody is more actively suicidal?
Them doing something to themselves that could really harm them.
Okay, so it might be that there is action. What else could it look like?
Well, there's a plan for an action.
Yeah.
I have a gun.
Mm-hmm.
They're giving away their stuff.
Right.
No. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if somebody starts talking to you and saying stuff like, yeah, you know, they were talking about being depressed or talking about feeling down. They said, you know, yesterday I pulled out my gun and just kind of looked at it and just thought about it, held it. That's a little bit more active. They are further down the road and saying, even if they're not saying, they might even say, I'm not going to kill myself. But they've started, as you said, they started identifying pieces of the plan. That's a greater cause for concern. That's an immediate safety need. And that's something where you want to get involved with, maybe it's somebody else relationally, but we want to get them to a therapist if they already have one, or if it's really bad, to a doctor. And again, you guys are lay people, you're civilians. If I hadn't told you this, and a really good friend of yours came up and was having suicidal thoughts, what would you naturally want to do? You wouldn't walk away. If it was somebody you really loved, you would want to get help. Follow that gut instinct. All I want to reassure you is that there may be times where there still is some of that passivity that people are expressing, and I don't want you to feel afraid to engage it. Does that make sense? Any questions on this? Yeah.
Ryan had said that if somebody was trying to struggle with something like pornography, you mentioned, and it became central to their thinking,
mm-hmm.
it would make it worse. So they center around
what right.
they're struggling with. So if you are beginning to acknowledge and interact with these suicidal thoughts, wouldn't that then make it worse?
Okay.
Why does it make it better?
So the question is, as Ryan brought up, somebody that might be struggling with something like pornography, if they center on it, they can kind of cycle through, focus on it, it'll escalate, make it worse. So part of what Ryan is talking about there is this idea that, and we'll talk about this in a second with anxiety, because it's a good picture in anxiety, that sometimes the more we ruminate and focus on what it is, it can actually do the opposite of increasing our understanding and awareness, and we just start to spiral downward. In acknowledging or understanding, just to be clear, when somebody brings up maybe passive or talks about it, a lot of us have that gut instinct to kind of be like, whoa, that's...
We don't want to go there.
Yeah. Like, that's not something That's not something I grew up talking about in my family. So I have had to go through a transition where being at Peachford, where I've had people come up to me and say, I am going to kill myself today if you let me leave this hospital. My temptation is to be like, I'm out. Like, I don't know what to do. Somebody else. But acknowledging and being able to say to someone, I hear you, is not saying, well, tell me every little piece of what you're thinking, and you need to think about that more and focus. It's acknowledging, moving them towards help. Go ahead and speak to that if I'm not getting the difference.
The big difference between what Michael's saying and what I was trying to talk about before is if somebody's making their whole life revolve around the issue, then that's different than acknowledging, right? So if every waking moment, quote, I'm exaggerating, if every waking moment I'm overly concerned with how am I going to recover from porn, and that's how I spend my entire day, that's where it's become the dominant center of life. And if it becomes the dominant center of life, typically things get worse. So oftentimes with a client who's depressed, the joke that some therapists say about people who are depressed is that they're the most narcissistic people in the world because everything's about their pain, right? So that's kind of like the joke, quote unquote. But there's some reality to that, you know, in the sense of, are they always, always focused on it? And if so, then that could actually make things worse. It reinforces that it's always gonna be there. And they actually form their identity around it. And once a client forms their identity around something like depression or anything else that Michael's going to talk about, way harder to get them to shift because now it's, this is who I am. Now it's a whole other level. This is what I do.
And some of that is to point out, that's why referring to a professional is key here, because that's what we are trained to do, is going to that next level. For your purposes, being able to identify what you're saying, you could still see somebody might have focused on suicide so much that is... it does have a similar thing, but acknowledging it. And I want to be clear, maybe not everyone in this room has ever thought or struggled with, but a lot of people don't think or consider suicide because they want to die. They think about it or consider it because they want their suffering to stop. So if you can imagine, if you haven't before, going through so much pain that feels like an option, that should cause some sense of empathy and joining with someone and understanding that, wow, it feels so heavy that you would consider doing something that extreme that's permanent just to get your suffering to stop. And that's part of the acknowledgement of, I hear you, let's go get help, but I'm here. I'm not going to run away. I'm not going to isolate you further or tell you, don't think that, don't talk about that. I mean, don't think that, but... we don't want to minimize it in a way that makes them feel more isolated, if that makes sense.
You're acknowledging someone who hasn't been acknowledged.
Mm-hmm.
Think about it that way. You're acknowledging someone who does not feel like anyone even sees them.
Yeah.
And so you're actually bringing out of the darkness into light, saying, I see you, let's talk about it.
And I see your pain that maybe hasn't been acknowledged. Yeah, that's good. Okay, anxiety. Anxiety, the great way to think of it, is excessive worry that impairs functioning. All of us worry, but anxiety and people that struggle with anxiety to the point that it is a problem is when it starts to impair functioning. So you hear people talk about, I'm so worried I couldn't get out of bed this morning. That's impairing functioning. You're not able to function. Often this manifests itself in panic attacks. If you've ever had a panic attack, you know that panic attacks are for real. It is a physical response that happens inside your body. There's kind of a lot of interesting science to it that the cycle of what happens when you start to have a panic attack is you start to breathe. Your body is prepared for fight or flight, but we don't fight or flee. And so as it's ramping up for you to work out, your breathing increases. So if you've ever had a panic attack or seen people that have them, they start breathing really hard, right? So that imbalance of CO2 and oxygen in the body makes you lightheaded, further causes you to panic because you start feeling lightheaded and like, I'm not okay. If you're ever around somebody that has a panic attack, and this is part of what I was saying to your point, the worst thing they can do is focus on the anxiety and the panic. That's only going to make it worse. So we talk about grounding techniques. that's simply having someone tune into something other than the panic. And there's a ton, you can Google, there's a ton of different grounding techniques. You may never use them. You might use them yourself or use them with your kids. One of my favorite ones is 5-4-3-2-1. Tell me 5 things you see in this room, 4 things you hear, 3 things you smell, 2 things you touch, 1 thing about yourself. And it causes the person to, and you get them to breathe slowly, and as they're naming it, you're forcing them to focus on something other than the anxiety. If you remember from the stats, anxiety disorders, that's one of the biggest ones people struggle with. So it is more common, but again, we're moving beyond just somebody that maybe worries into somebody that worries so much that they're not getting out of bed, or they're performing poorly at work because they get so anxious before they give a presentation, or things that you're starting to see it's a real problem and affects them. Does that make sense? Trauma. People that have trauma in their lives or traumatic experiences can re-experience them through triggers, things that remind them of the event, whether that's a noise, person's name, a smell, anything that causes them to re-experience. Trauma happens like that in cycles, and people that get caught in those cycles have a really difficult time understanding when they are safe. So you can be sitting in a room like this and all of a sudden experience a moment that triggers the trauma that you experienced. And even though you know without a doubt that you're sitting in this room and you're not in the car where the traumatic experience happened, your body can start to respond to the trauma. And they start to feel as if it's happening again. They don't feel safe. What makes Ryan's telling of his story different? Why was Ryan able to tell his story that was traumatic in front of you guys and talk about it and engage with you in it? Any thoughts? Sorry?
It's part of his bona fides.
His what?
In other words, it's part of his street cred.
Okay. That's what I thought you were saying. I thought I misheard you. It's part of his street cred. Okay.
In other words, it's part of his professional presentation.
But what's the difference between him doing that and what we're talking here with trauma?
Focus on the events, each thing as it happened, and not on the emotions that he was feeling.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay. I would agree with that in part, but Ryan also experienced some emotion last month, for those of you that were here, so there is still some emotion. Were you going to say something? Yeah. So you're hitting on it. Ryan has worked on it more broadly. Yes. And that piece of that is the forgiveness. Ryan has worked on his trauma so that as he talks about it or as he experiences things, he is not being triggered. So he's able to talk about it in a way where he practices emotional control. Yeah, he experienced some emotions. It's still a hard story. But if Ryan stood up here and said, I've never told this story before to anyone, starts telling you guys, and becomes completely undone such that he can't finish the presentation, that would not be healthy. He would not be in a good space. So if you're talking with somebody and you're noticing that as they're sharing with you something really hard and it seems like this is bringing up some things in a way that, are you going to be okay talking about this? Do we need to slow down? Do you don't have to keep telling me? Trust your gut on that. If it feels like it's going somewhere where they are not going to be okay, they might be re-experiencing trauma. All right, alcohol and drug use, very quickly. Substance abuse, substance use, drug use, habitual usage that is, again, impairment in functioning. There are a lot of different ways to classify this. Some people would think even occasional usage is wrong. Some people think a little bit more liberal usage is okay. I don't want it to be a debate about, we have criteria that we look at, but I'm saying for your purposes, if you start to see someone express or you see in their life that there is usage and it impairs functioning somehow. So in some ways it's maybe causing them to make poor decisions. In some ways, especially with illicit drug use, that's a problem because it's illegal. That is a poor choice to do things that are illegal. That's what we want to look for. It's a mood altering substance. So like Ryan just said, what's the mood they're trying to alter? I'm not saying that so that you figure out what that mood is, but I'm challenging you that what commonly happens with substance use is people focus so much on the behavior, and if we can just get you to stop the behavior, then this will stop. But there is something happening at some point that someone says, I don't like this mood, so I want to alter it with this substance so that I don't have to feel the mood. That's where it starts. Understand what it takes to change. It's not just behavior change. So I worked in the addictions unit at Peachford for a little bit, and I saw people that would come in that said, so my husband, my wife dropped me off here. They're making me be here. I don't want to be here. And I'm thinking, I'm like ready for battle royale. Like, well, the door's locked. You're here. The guy I worked with would say, you're free to leave. Because he recognized that where they were, it was just going to be about a behavior change. They weren't ready to work on it. I say that to you not to say that means you just throw your hands up and say, well, oh, well, but you have to be prepared and understand that there could be resistance. If somebody is not very aware of or is not ready to accept that they might have a problem, you saying, I think you should see a professional might cause a little bit of frustration. No, I do not need to see a professional. You're crazy. This isn't a problem. Unfortunately, you can't make someone get better. So what that means is be prepared for a long process. It's going to take, in relationship, a lot of high touch, a lot of intentionality, a lot of being willing to be in that ambivalence of watching someone make poor choices, but understanding that eventually either things will break down or they will get to a point where it kind of falls to pieces. Or they'll have moments of sobriety and realize, this is what I don't want to deal with. This is where. And that's why it is a long process. And as you maybe continue to encourage them to seek help, as people around them encourage them to seek help, some of that is a little bit more of a waiting game. This is a hard one. And I think this happens in the church more than we like to admit. And like to see that it's a struggle for a lot of people. And I've felt very passionate in the last couple of years about wanting to see the church handle this better and create space for people to struggle a little bit more and not feel like it's something to keep in the shadows and not talk about, because that's where it gets worse. Any questions about this before we do the last slide? All right. The referral process. Part of it is knowing what kind of counselors you can refer to, whether that is the church having a list, which could be a good thing. It might be you personally starting to research and figure out who you trust, asking people who you trust. Not all therapists have openings all the time. It's good to call and just say, I want to get a sense of how you receive clients. What kind of clients do you work with? Having that kind of knowledge handy is helpful. As therapists, we try to market as much as we can, but it counts on people like you who are saying, hey, I know of this person. I know where their office is. I know what kind of stuff they do. Let me help you call them. How you deliver this to someone is important. You've done the joining, hopefully. It's okay. You know, some of you talked about worrying about what if I have the wrong answer? What if I don't know the answer? It's okay to say to someone, this sounds really serious. This sounds really hard. I don't really know what to say. Sounds like you could maybe benefit from talking to a professional, because I have zero experience working. Like, you just shared a really traumatic event, and that, man, that sounds really hard. When you communicate these things as you're joined with someone, you're communicating it with empathy. That's going to sound a lot different than, I'm going to stop you there, go talk to a therapist. Go work with a professional. You're way more messed up. We want to couch it with empathy. Still joining. As they pursue that, or as you're talking to them, ask them, how can I still walk through this with you as you're seeing a professional? Do you want me to still be a part of this? Do you want me to kind of check in with you? Some people might say, yeah, you know, I'd love next week after I see the counselor to come and talk to you. Your job still is the same. Continue to join. What are you learning in there? What's kind of come out? Take the pressure off yourself to know how to solve these things and focus more on joining with the person and what they're going through. And that removes some of that, what if I say the wrong thing? Ryan and I say the wrong thing in session all the time. I've had to apologize to clients. Ryan Maybe. No. He's never apologizing. He doesn't have to. He gets it right. What am I talking about? We still have moments where we miss something, say the wrong things. But the important piece, even in therapy, even as professionals, is when we're willing to be human and bring that into the relationship. I'm sorry I misunderstood you there. I'm sorry, I didn't even realize I minimized that piece. Tell me more about that. Tell me how you feel. Like, help me get into that. That's what we're looking for. Any last questions?